Ready? Call to order the committee, the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. Today is May 6th, and we have four items on our agenda. We're going to be having public hearings on House Bills 2277, 2444, 2460, and 2461. And let me see how many people have signed up for each of those. I think what we're going to do is we're going to take them in that order. So with that, and it's just public hearings today, so we're missing a few colleagues, but you know what? It's time to get, their loss. No,
they can catch up.
Time to get going.
They can go to OLIS and get the playback.
Yeah. So we're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2277A. And Ian, if you would tell us briefly what the bill does, and I'll call forward some folks to kick it off. Reed Wagner, Mark Landauer, and Hong Nguyen.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2277A would expand the definition of the Drainage District Act and authorize drainage districts to carry out activities for the purposes of the act, including enacting ordinances and charging fees.
Good afternoon, Chair Edwards, members of the committee. My name is Mark Landauer, here on behalf of Multnomah County Drainage District. With me today is Reed Wagner, the Executive Director of Multnomah County Drainage District, as well as Hong Nguyen, who is legal counsel to the district. And we will provide you a presentation about what this bill is seeking to address, and then, of course, take any questions that you may have.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Reed Wagner, Executive Director of Multnomah County Drainage District. I also provide service, and we as an agency provide service to three other drainage districts along the Columbia Corridor, spanning from the Sandy River to Smith and Bybee Lakes. While I'm here representing these four districts, many other districts in the state, as well as cities, are going to be facing the same problems that we are going to talk about today. While we don't have responsibility or obligation over those areas, we just think it's very important that we recognize that this problem is being dealt with elsewhere. The districts were formed in 1917 under ORS 547 to drain farmland and extend the farming season. As residential and industrial development occurred in the area, levees were developed. After the devastating Vanport floods in 1948, the Army Corps completed the 27 miles of levee system that are there today. The districts agreed through a contract to maintain these levees. However, we were never given the statutory authority to do so. Since then, the development behind the levees has changed dramatically. The levee system now protects 10% of Multnomah County jobs in the area. The Portland International Airport, the Troutdale Airport, the water wells, which are the region's backup water supply, the distribution hub for the state, and 17% of the buildable industrial land inventory within our urban growth boundary. Where once this was a farming community, there are now only three working farms in the area. Next slide, please. We continue to provide drainage by redistributing rainfall and influent water. We operate pump stations, culverts, and open waterways in coordination with our partners at DEQ, the Environmental Services Departments of our cities, and the Columbia Slough Watershed Council. For this, we have statutory authority. We also provide flood protection. In the 50s is when we entered into the contract with the Corps to maintain the system. If we meet our obligations with the Corps, the community receives assistance in flood fighting during high water events and assistance in repairing levees after high water events. For this, we don't have the statutory authority. Next slide, please. Additionally, maintaining the levees to FEMA standards allows the community to retain accreditation. If the levees are not maintained and the community loses accreditation, the area is mapped as a floodplain by FEMA. Landowners then have to pay flood insurance, and development regulations are restricted dramatically. The loss of accreditation places community assets and values at risk. A big concern is if the 17% of our region's buildable industrial land inventory can't be developed due to a loss of accreditation, the question arises, where does this future industrial property go? In the Portland metropolitan region, that's probably in the farmland and forest land outside the UGB right now. Next slide, please. We do flood in our communities along the Columbia River. The way the federal government defines flooding is by different types of year floods. So a 1 in 100 year flood, a 1 in 500 year flood. Over the last 120 years, we've had 400 year events and 2 500 year events. So we do flood in this area, and we will continue to flood as we're defined by our waterways. Next up, slide, please. Our goal is to limit the impact of flooding in the community. Our community has experienced devastation, most notably in 1948 when the city of Amport was hit by a breach in the levee. At least 15 people died, and an entire community was devastated. We still maintain the levee in that area around Amport. It's sometimes referred to as the railroad embankment along Smith and Bybee Lakes. With the districts contractually, next slide, please. With the districts contractually obligated to maintain the levees to core standards and the community's need to ensure the levees accreditation, we're seeking to align our authorities with these obligations and needs. Next slide. Our community recognizes the significance of this corridor and our flood control system. A broad group of partners have come together to consider the right level of flood protection and ensure the levees are accredited. This group has recognized the limited capacity of the districts and has been working toward collaborative solutions to achieve accreditation. This group by itself can't solve the statutory limitations placed on the districts, and that's why we're here asking for necessary adjustments to our statute. Next slide. There are districts all over the state, and as I said before, there are also cities that are going to have to deal with these issues. Changes with the federal government's view of standards after Katrina has had a big impact on these communities, whether they are drainage districts, cities, or counties that are dealing with these issues. We're going to have to deal with more governance issues down the road as these different communities are impacted. And with that, I'll say thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Go ahead and finish out the panel.
Very good. Mr. Chair, just for your understanding, Mr. Wagner mentioned the Amport flood, and I want to just point out to you where that breach actually took place back in the late 40s, and it was right at this point here, and this was in part the community of Amport that effectively was flooded, as Mr. Wagner described. What I'd like to do just very briefly is review with you some of the highlights that are contained in the bill that are the substantive changes that we're seeking to accomplish here. Just very briefly, and I'm going to skip many of the sections contained in the bill because there's just some cleaning up that has been done by legislative council in some cases, and in other cases just minor tweaks. But the substantive changes that I think should be brought to your attention, of course, Section 2, which add or expands the definitions of flood control project, obstruction, or repair. Section 4 sets forth a process that the drainage district must follow to enact ordinances as authorized under Section 5. The ordinance making authority under this measure would be limited to just those districts contained within Multnomah County. The reason for that is when this bill was originally introduced over on the House side, we received a great deal of concern from the Oregon Farm Bureau. They were very concerned about ordinance making authority across drainage districts in the state of Oregon, and through some discussions with them, we modified the measure to just apply for the purposes of ordinance making authority to just those drainage districts within Multnomah County. Section 6 defines a drainage district in a county of in excess of 700,000, again, Multnomah County, as an urban service provider for the purposes of the district entering into urban service agreements with the cities that have their boundaries within those districts. And that's important because it sets up a process by which the two bodies can communicate in a more structured manner. So, for example, if the City of Portland issues a building permit for a development within the drainage district itself, the city's development department will communicate with the drainage district to ensure that there aren't any encroachments that are created as a result of the new development. And of course, an encroachment on a levee is considered a very bad thing and is against the Army Corps of Engineers regulations for being able to certify a levee. Section 8 simply makes Sandy Drainage Improvement Company, and Sandy Drainage Improvement Company is the drainage company that is at the far east of these four drainage facilities. They're just organized under a separate statute, I believe it, what is it, 554? And so they're a little bit of a different animal, and so we're doing just the same thing that we did with the regular drainage districts. And then finally, Section 8 just clarifies that flood control is within the drainage district's authority, and it is also provides a process for an owner or occupant of land which has become clogged for the obstruction or for the owner to submit a plan to the district and a schedule for the repair of any obstructions that happen within their own land. Finally, or a couple of parting shots or notes here. The measure is supported by the City of Portland, Multnomah County, the Port of Portland, the Columbia Corridor Association, as well as Metro. We've worked very hard to address many of the concerns that were expressed by the Oregon Farm Bureau, and we thank them for their feedback on this. We also addressed some of the concerns that were expressed by Water Watch. We removed a couple of items in the definition of flood control project at this time, although I do know that they continue to have some concerns, and Ms. Wynn will attempt to address the concerns that were addressed in Water Watch's letter to the committee today.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair, for allowing us to have this opportunity today. As Mr. Landauer has mentioned, I will be addressing just a couple of the concerns raised by Water Watch. The main theme of their concern is that the changes were proposed.
Could you say your name for the record?
Oh, my name is Hong Nguyen, H-U-Y-N-H. Win or lose, I win. for the record, yeah.
Water Watch, you're on notice.
We got that one. She's on my side.
So their main theme is that we're adding to the authorities or expanding new authorities that doesn't exist, and that is not what we're trying to do. We're not adding anything new, nor are we expanding as authorities as expansive as they believe we are providing. One particular note they called out was our definition of flood control and what that means, and having some particular concerns of the broadness of some language. When we helped drafted this legislation, we made sure that we didn't go outside of the existing authorities that are on the books to the extent that they are available for other entities. So flood control, the definition of flood control is taken right out of other chapters in the ORS, in particular 549, which provides authorities for the state and the county to operate flood control projects and in contracts with the U.S. Corps of Engineers for those purposes. So they're already on the books for the county, for the state. They're also on the books for the sister county improvement, the Drainage Improvement Corporation, the 554 entity, as Mr. Landauer mentioned. They're also on the books for improvement drainage companies, the ORS 552 entities. So these flood control authorities are already on the books for other entities. We're just trying to make them consistent for the drainage districts that operate flood control projects. Their other concern, again, is with respect to the broadness of and the expansion of our condemnation right as it relates to flood control. Again, these other entities that already have flood control authorities have condemnation rights. And so we are adopting what is already out there with respect to the drainage districts and making it consistent with the obligations that we have agreed to carry out for with the Corps. So with that, I think that that's about it.
And Mr. Chair, I just know it's my recollection that the districts, Mr. Wagner can correct me if I'm wrong, have not exercised eminent domain since his memory, and certainly in the recent past for the district, and certainly wouldn't anticipate having to do so unless, and of course, the Army Corps of Engineers had identified an area that was not presently owned by the district that needed some fortification or another cross levee or what have you for the purposes of the certification.
That's correct.
Okay. Great. Questions of committee members? Questions of the panelists by committee members? Yeah, Senator Olson.
Thank you very much. It says on page 3, line 38, in a contiguous body of a swamp, wet or overflowed land or irrigated land from which waters contribute to the swamp or to the wet or overflowed condition of the same or different land, the owners of record of at least 50% of the acreage may form a drainage district for the purpose of reclaiming and protecting the land by drainage, flood control, or otherwise from the effects of water. Then, and an area that you skipped over, Mr. Landauer, which was section 5 on fees.
Yes.
A drainage district may acquire, construct, reconstruct, repair, improve, et cetera, a drainage district in the county with a population over 700,000, and they can charge fees.
Yes, sir.
So would that mean that the good chair and I could find a piece of wetland in Portland and form a drainage district and then charge the city a fee?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, thank you for the question. I'm glad that you pointed that out. The district has identified the need to be able to charge fees for the purposes of reviewing development plans. The district, of course, does not have a very large budget, and as a result, it would be very, we would anticipate that when development is proposed within the district, that they will likely, in all likelihood, have to hire an engineer to ensure that whatever development is in fact taking place does not in some way create an encroachment or a problem for the drainage system. And it being able to reimburse that consultative service is going to be very important for the district. And I'm sure Mr. Wagner can tag on if there are other issues that raises.
Before you go farther, follow up.
Yeah.
My question was, could the good chair and I form a drainage district, which use and the bill allows me to on page 3,
mm-hmm.
and then therefore, since we have a drainage district, can we then therefore levy fees
okay.
against
Very good.
The city?
I understand your question now. Forgive me, Chair Edwards, Senator Olson. If that district were formed within Multnomah County, the answer would be yes.
Okay.
Otherwise, the answer would be no, because again, Senator Olson, the ability to enact ordinances and therefore charge fees is only confined to the Multnomah County.
I understand. Thank you. One follow-up, please.
Yeah.
Another question that I have, on these fees and rates and fines and charges, is there a cap established in the bill saying that you can't charge the good senator and I own the district and we charge Portland $100 million for our wetland? Is there a cap of a fee?
As much as we would like to charge the city of Portland $100 million, that would probably take care of our accreditation challenge here in fortifying the levees. I don't anticipate that will occur. But no, Senator, there is not a cap on the fees. And perhaps Mr. Wagner is the best to frankly answer this question.
Senator Olson and Edwards, actually, we all our boards are elected officials. And so while there's not a cap on fees, there certainly is an accountability by the decision makers when it comes to setting those fees from the ordinances. But because there is a huge variation in the fees associated with different type of development review. For instance, if we have a large industrial property come in versus a small residential development, we were not able to be able to scale a set of fees here.
One last question.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that answer. You're relying on the people, as we do, to make an informed decision and set a price. I've seen how Portland operates. That does make me a little nervous.
So,
but there's no, you don't need to answer.
There was no
that.
Question there.
No
I'm
question, no question.
But you're a country boy, those big cities, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
So without the bill, let's say, you know, session comes and goes, and you don't get the bill, then what happens?
Thank you for that question, Chair Edwards. We would continue to operate with limited authority and unclear authority. We would potentially have to fight off other lawsuits. In the past, we've faced lawsuits over these issues, and I think that if we had these authorities on the books, we could have prevented it.
And if I might add, yeah, Chair Edwards, to give you a sense of scale, and our last fiscal year, we spent hundreds of thousands of dollars defending a lawsuit versus spending the money to protect the properties in the area. And that's, to me, doesn't seem like a very efficient way to operate the organization.
And Mr. Chair, I'd just provide just a very, very brief example. This and why the communication between the cities and the districts are so important. The city of Portland, and I'm certainly not casting blame or anything, they were entirely within their right to do so, but issued a permit to a certain, we'll just say utility for example sakes, and that utility placed a lateral within the levee. By doing so, again, is in direct conflict with the regulations that are put together by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. In that case, the district had to sue the utility in order to remove that lateral through the levee. Ultimately, the judge ruled in favor of the district, but that was again, an expense to the district that could have been used to help maintain or fortify the existing facilities that they're responsible for. So this measure in some way gives them the ability to ensure that those kind of things won't happen again, and hopefully that the communication will occur between the permitting entities as well as the district before anything like that could happen again.
Just a point of clarification, Chair Edwards. The lawsuit was actually initiated by the utility against us to get a declaration that they could leave that cable in the levee.
Got it. Thank you. And so lawsuits are typically of that nature. I mean, is it affected properties? Is it watchdog groups? Is it utilities in this case? I mean, where's the legal activity tend to happen here?
A lot of.
If we pass this bill, will you still have a job?
I'm not too concerned about the job as much as keeping the cost down for the district. A lot of the activities that I see are with respect to development on the levee, and how we can control that. And so. Right now, without the ability to pass ordinance to regulate those kind of uses, we have to rely on our real property interest rights, easements, right-of-ways. And they're nowhere near a perfect record of all the interests we should have. And if we have issues and we wanted to enforce that, we would have to take that to the court and assert our rights under those easement rights to get them out. Or condemnation.
Okay. Other questions of the panel?
No.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you each.
Thank you.
Jonathan Manton, you're up next.
Good Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Manton, here today on behalf of Water Watch of Oregon. Appreciate the opportunity to be here with you very much to talk about this bill just a little bit. And it's one that's come to my attention kind of late in this process. There was an amendment offered over in the House and some changes made, and maybe we can just get some clarification moving forward as to what the bill actually does versus doesn't do. Because our understanding is a little bit different than what's been described to you just previously. We still oppose the bill now, but we certainly don't oppose giving this authority to the Multnomah Drainage District. So if we could limit this bill's reach to just apply to that to solve the problems that you heard of, we would be fine with. We're concerned with this expansion of this authority to the districts, the ability to create drainage districts elsewhere across the state. And it does give some pretty dramatic expansion of authority. It's not that the authority doesn't exist elsewhere, as Ms. Wynn was testifying to. Agreed to, but this would be giving that authority to drainage districts. And that authority, based on the definitions that are in the bill, for example, a flood control project, it would be given that authority that's found within the Drainage District Act to now be applicable to flood control projects. And if you look at that definition at Section 2, Line 9, a flood control project is a system or method. It's including but not limited to the things that are listed beneath that. A flood control project could be most anything. Specifically in B beneath that, a flood control project could be for the purpose of protection of life and property against danger, menace, injury, and damage resulting from floodwater, or an excessive or unusual accumulation of water. Like, what's an unusual accumulation of water? Could a district be formed and then with the authority of condemnation that's given here, be able to then, based on unusual accumulation of water, you could potentially even go after things like peak flows and some pretty other larger scale ramifications. I think we can get to, I don't think that's the intent of from speaking with some of the bill's proponents. I think we can get to a solution that fixes these problems. We have newfound trust between the parties and some of the other negotiations that have been going on other bills we're working on. So maybe we can just have some time to get together and hammer out, because I think there's just at this point a difference of opinion as to what the language of the bill does and what authorities would be granted and what the implications could be elsewhere. I mean, the way we read the bill, for example, you could have a farmer in the desert whose land could be condemned through powers of eminent domain, and then, you know, implications unknown at that point. So I would just appreciate the chance to maybe get some of our attorneys a little bit more time to look at the actual language of the bill and maybe find a neutral third party to assess what it does and try to fix it.
Okay. Thanks. Questions for Jonathan? Yes, Senator Olson.
Kind of goes to the question I asked then, wasn't it? Can we form a flood control district or a drainage district and then assess fees? I can see your concerns.
Chair Edwards and Senator Olson, that is exactly it. And I think that the answer before was that the fees assessment would only apply to the Multnomah County area based on what the amended version does. But the other parts of the Drainage District Act still apply statewide, is my understanding. And maybe I have that wrong, but part of that other power is the power of eminent domain.
Follow up?
Yeah.
So your solution then is to limit it to Multnomah County Drainage District and nowhere else, nothing outside of Multnomah County?
Chair Edwards and Senator Olson, if that was the case, we would be neutral.
Okay. And I guess maybe you guys, well, never mind, that's not up for me. You guys got arm wrestle. I was just wondering if you would have those discussions and bring this bill back with an amendment to meet your concerns, and if it works for you guys, maybe that would be the way to go.
Chair Edwards and Senator Olson, we'd be happy to do that. Appreciate the opportunity to do so.
Okay. Any other
questions? That would be a win-win then, right?
Then, in that case, we would have a win-win.
Any other questions for Jonathan? Okay, thank you. Would anybody else like to testify on House Bill 2277A? Okay, we don't have it scheduled for a work session yet, so I think that it sounds like we're pretty much on the same page, although there have been other negotiations in the world of water that I thought we were really close on, and we're still not there yet. But I think you guys can get there. So we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2277A and move on the agenda. So we will now open up a public hearing on House Bill 2444. And Ian, if you could tell us a little bit about what the bill does, and we'll call forth Lisa Hansen and Stephanie Page.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2444 would authorize the Department of Agriculture to coordinate agricultural mediation services for disputes directly related to activities of the department and agricultural issues under jurisdiction of the department. The measure would also remove language regarding foreclosure mediation, as well as remove a regulation on the price cap for mediation services.
All right.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Department of Agriculture. Before you, House Bill 2444 is another one of our agency cleanup modernization bills. You may or may not be aware of a small program within the department that we have, which is a mediation program for agricultural issues. It was established in the 90s to deal with farm foreclosures at the time. Sometime later, it was amended by the legislature to expand the type of cases that could come to our mediation program. What we do in it today, for the most part, we do a lot of labor cases. There are some nuisance cases that come to us as well. So what we have proposed and worked with stakeholders on in House Bill 2444 is to get rid of some of the old language that referred to foreclosures. That's carried out by another entity outside of the Department of Agriculture, and then just to modernize the language around recouping the costs. I think the statute currently says we shall recoup the costs. We receive some money to help offset the costs of the program to the participants, and I think that's been appreciated as we've dealt with some of the labor cases that come to us. So with that, I'll pause. Stephanie Page worked on putting this bill together with our stakeholders and would be happy to walk you through the bill or add anything that I've missed.
Go ahead,
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Stephanie Page with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. I'll just share a few quick statistics about the program. And as Deputy Director Hansen said, I'm happy to walk you through the bill after that or just stop there. The program typically takes about 11 to 12 cases per year. As Deputy Director Hansen said, the vast majority of those are labor-related cases, so they could be wage and hour, harassment-related issues, for example. There is an especially high settlement rate for the labor-related cases that the program accepts. The overall successful settlement rate is about 80%. There's no pressure for participants in the program to settle, but the mediator attempts to clarify the issues and see if a settlement can be reached. We send post-participation anonymous surveys out to participants, and about 98% of the folks who have responded to those surveys said they would recommend the program to someone else. So even the folks who don't settle seem to think that it was worth participating. And I think one reason the program is especially popular in labor cases is that it is a very fast and efficient alternative to either having an investigation or going through the court system. And the cases, once they get scheduled for mediation, last about 6 hours. And the mediations can typically be scheduled anywhere from 2 weeks to a month after we receive the applications from both parties in our office. So I will conclude there unless you would like me to go section by section, and I would be happy to do that if you'd like.
Yeah, why don't you walk us through the sections,
okay.
Please? Thank you.
Sure.
I'm sitting here scrolling through.
Oh, sure. No, that's fine. Glad to do that. Section 1 repeals some definitions and foreclosure-related language, as does Section 2, and it also moves some detail into rule. As far as the fees that would be charged, it states that we will adopt rules to determine those. Section 3, again, deletes referrals to some of the foreclosure-related language, which the program no longer handles. Okay, and then Section 4, again, deletes a significant amount of foreclosure language and moves some detail into rule about how we are to contact participants in the program, for example. the time frame for folks getting back to us. That can be clarified in rule. Section 5, again, deletes some foreclosure-related language, puts some terminology into more plain language or rewords things to more plain language, as does Section 7. Section 8, again, some very minor plain language types of edits. And then Section 9 deletes a couple of references to foreclosure-related language. It talks about a creditor there, for example, and that's proposed for deletion.
Okay. Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Chair Edwards. I was looking at the bill, and it referenced rescinding ORS-whatever. And then later in the bill, it kept referring to that, even though it says we're going to rescind it, we're still referring to it. So that was a little confusing. Mm-hmm. Does that get cleaned up somewhere? Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Thompson, we asked the same question of Legislative Council when they drafted the bill for us, and they assured us that that gets taken care of at the end of the session.
Okay. All right. Thanks. I just wanted on record that I read the bill.
I was
I knew you were surprised.
I was like, wow.
Yeah.
He's been reading the bills all session.
Yeah,
even when you're not here. Senator Olson.
Thank you. And I asked you this when you were in my office. Mm-hmm. How many mediators do you have?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, we have 3 mediators on contract with the program.
But they don't work for
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, they do not work for Department of Ag. The mediation coordinator, special assistant to Director Koba, coordinates the program and takes in the applications and then refers those to one of the 3 mediators on contract.
Follow-up?
Yeah, follow-up.
Is the expensive remediation, is that handed off to the 2 parties to pay for the mediation, or is it picked up by Department of Ag and then you bill?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, for labor cases, there is no cost to the participants. So the department receives some funding to cover the cost of providing that service.
Where would that funding come from?
I believe it's general fund. Court filing fees. Okay.
Okay. Okay. And then follow-up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You said there you have 10 to 12 cases a year,
mm-hmm.
and most of those are labor related. What would be the length of time for mediation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, the average time for mediation is 6 hours, and that's if you're referring to the time that the mediator is actually meeting with the 2 parties.
And does that include the answer, the solution to the problem, or does that come later?
That's correct. That includes arriving at the solution.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Or arriving at a settlement, if that's possible.
And I was going to ask that same question, but Senator Thompson beat me to it. You want to know what the answer is? They fix the numbers after the bill is engrossed.
Okay. Okay.
Didn't know that.
Did
I ask the same question?
Are there? Okay. So, a couple of questions. If we don't pass this bill, for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. Then what happens or doesn't happen?
Mr. Chair, the program could continue to operate as it does. I would say a benefit is that anyone reading the statute in the future, if it is passed, will understand more clearly what types of cases are or aren't eligible for the program. It was very confusing to me when I took over coordinating the program, what we could or couldn't accept.
Okay. Okay. And then could you talk a little bit about anytime we're moving fees into rule, little antenna goes up. Mm-hmm. So, okay, could you expand on that a little bit? Why? I can understand why you would want them in rule, but why should we put them in rule?
Mr. Chair, I think we heard feedback from stakeholders that they would like us to have the ability to recover the cost of providing the service if we ever lost the current source of funding that we have for the program. Some of our department stakeholders are concerned about costs of fees, for example, and the administrative costs associated with those. And so they want to help us keep our costs as low as possible. They would like us to be able to recover costs if we ever lost our court filing fee source of funding for the program. Because that cost could change over time, it seemed to make sense to put it into rule. Currently, the statute says that we can charge no more than $30 per hour per party, but we must recoup the cost of providing the service, and the cost of the mediators per hour is more than $30 an hour. But at the same time, we'd like the flexibility to not charge people if we continue to receive that funding, just because most of our labor-related cases, one of the parties would not be able to afford that, even that minimal charge of $30 an hour.
Okay. Senator Denver, did you have a question?
No, I was just wondering how your mediation service intersects with BOLI's, or is an alternative to BOLI, or does something that BOLI doesn't do?
Senator Denver, that's an excellent question. I think just the speed with which our program can resolve issues, and the fact that it's housed at the Department of Agriculture that some farmers may be more comfortable with would be a couple reasons for it being popular.
Great, thank you.
Yeah, I guess I don't have any other questions. Any other questions? Mm-hmm. All right.
Hold it.
Hold on.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I need to clarify. Good thing Lauren was here. He said we don't get court filing fees anymore. It is general fund, so.
It is, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you for that clarification.
I apologize for the confusion.
Which especially means that you're always subject to having that pared back on a session-to-session basis. Okay, all right. Well, I don't see any other questions, so. Thank you both for being here. Is there anybody else that would like to testify on House Bill 2444 that didn't sign up? Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2444. We're going to move down the agenda. We're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2460A. Ian, if you could tell us what's happening on this bill, and Bill Ryan, if you could come forth to kick it off.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2460A would authorize the Department of State Lands to establish and impose a one-time application fee on persons applying for an easement to construct water, gas, electric, or communication service lines, fixture, or other facility on state lands. In addition, the measure would prohibit DSL from imposing an application fee more than once per application for easement.
All right. Go ahead.
For the record, I'm Bill Ryan, Assistant Director at the Department of State Lands, and thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House Bill 2460A. The bill would allow the Department of State Lands to charge a one-time application fee for entities applying for an easement to construct water, gas, electric, or communication service lines, fixtures, or other facilities on state lands. And the department manages submerged and submersible lands, commonly known as the bed and banks, under navigable and tidally influenced waterways, which also includes the territorial sea. And our oversight is focused on protecting the public trust rights of navigation, recreation, fisheries, and commerce on these waterways. When a use is proposed on these lands, such as a commercial marina or a cable crossing, the department assesses a fee, a rent, or a consideration to compensate for the loss of public trust rights, and also an application fee to cover the administrative costs of the review of the proposed use and the issuance of an authorization. All revenue from waterway authorizations is deposited into the Common School Fund, whose earnings are distributed twice a year to Oregon's K-12 public school districts. And also those revenues are also used to pay for the administration of the program as well. For some background, in the earlier part of the 20th century, Oregon was committed to bringing electricity and other utilities to rural parts of the state. And so the legislature, to help this process, allowed certain actions to occur free of charge outside of city limits, including the placement of utility lines and that sort of thing. And so we're no longer really building the state in that way. Those utility corridors are there. And so the department's proposing that we'd be allowed to assess a one-time application fee, $750 for most easements, $5,000 for easements in the territorial sea for utility lines and facilities that are outside city limits. And those fees are consistent with the fees that we currently charge other users or utilities within city limits at this time. We estimate the department would receive about $23,750 in the coming 2015-17 biennium if we had that fee available, and that's based upon assessing those fees. And we estimated approximately 25 utility easement applications coming in, and maybe one territorial C. That's where that number came from. And we worked closely with multiple utility interests to work on this bill to get to the A version, and I want to thank them for their help on that. And thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Any questions? Okay. I don't see any other questions. So. And you're the only one that signed up to testify, so we don't have it scheduled for a work session today, but I'm assuming between now and a work session, unless anybody else wants to come forth and testify now, we'll get some sort of feedback from potentially affected parties that they are okay with the bill. So, okay. All right. I'm going to close this low energy public hearing on House Bill 2460A. And that comment was no reflection on the presenter of the bill, more a reflection on the fact that the chair needs a cup of coffee. So, and we're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2461. And Ian, if you could tell us what the bill does, and then Bill, we'll turn it over to you.
Okay. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2461 would authorize the Department of State Lands to adopt rules providing additional exemptions to leasing requirements related to submersible lands. It declares an emergency and it's effective on passage.
All right.
For the record, my name is Bill Ryan, Assistant Director of the Department of State Lands, and thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 2461 today. So the bill, this is a fixed bill as a result of some inadvertent removal of language from our statutes in the 2011 session. This bill would add language back to ORS 274.043 to allow the department to continue offering low-cost registrations for small non-commercial structures on state-owned submerged and submersible lands. Examples of structures the department has allowed to have low-cost registrations through rule in the past include non-commercial docks up to 2,500 square feet in area, non-commercial boathouses up to 2,500 square feet, floating recreational cabins, boat ramps, and mooring buoys. So those are the types of structures that we're talking about here. Since 1998, the department had offered these lower cost registrations for docks and boathouses and that type of thing on waterways such as the Willamette River or Triangle Lake, these state-owned submerged and submersible lands. And those registrations range from $150 to $240 or to $420 per year, depending upon the size and the type of use. In 2011, the legislature passed Senate Bill 600, which created a number of changes, mostly exemptions to our leasing requirements. And that language that allowed the director through a rulemaking process to allow additional low-cost registrations was removed inadvertently as part of that statute. We encourage passing this bill so that the department will have the ability to, as people raise issues and different types of structures are raised or what have you, that we'd have the ability through a rulemaking process to allow low-cost registration for those. It would be unfortunate if we had to inform property owners of these small structures now that we'd need to go with a higher cost lease, with a leasing structure that's really aimed more at commercial type activities, which technically we should be doing, and we're hoping that we can fix that statute and be able to continue doing business as we had been. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Any questions for Mr. Ryan from committee members?
Very fast.
Yeah.
That is a compliment. Thank you.
Well, I don't have any questions either. Based upon his performance earlier in the committee hearing, I'm assuming that Senator Thompson has read the bill and doesn't have any questions. You do have questions, you don't have questions.
I don't even know what bill you're on.
Just giving you a bad time.
I might have a 2461.
2461. Okay. Yeah, don't have any questions, so thank you. Anybody else want to testify on 2461? Anybody? Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2461. That clears the agenda for the day, so we are adjourned. Here's the agenda for the day, so we are